personally, I always felt that the strongest suit for gays was to be bohemian and to live outside traditional society. But I'm all for gay adoption, gay marriage, gay inheritance, gay whatever. It used to be that when I would meet somebody who was gay, if I didn't know anything else about them, I tended to credit them with being a little bit more intelligent than the average run of humanity. Now I tend to think of them as being slightly dumber. I think, well, would it be any better to be a heterosexual writer and have to write about adultery all the time in suburban life? It seems to me that at least gay people can write about a lot of exciting things.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Literary icon Edmund White chats up gay life, politics, and work. Mardi Gras gets launched in Sydney while Auckland previews its hero, and conservative clergy in Uganda and the Cayman Islands use their Bibles to battle equality. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And filling in for Chase Schulte, I'm Greg Gordon.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending February 10th, 2001. The gay and lesbian festival season kicked off this week with events in Australia and New Zealand. New Zealand's 11th annual Hero Festival held a two-hour grand opening in Auckland Central Square, which was draped with pink flags for the occasion. Among about 1,000 spectators were Prime Minister Helen Clark, Auckland Mayor Christine Fletcher, and transsexual Member of Parliament Georgina Bayer. Dykes on Bikes rumbled into the square, followed by drag queens singing We Are Family. Then, with a fanfare, a colored banner dropped, three rainbow flags were raised, and 250 doves were released. A sampling of festival performers gave a preview of a week of events to climax with a parade and a party at Auckland Town Hall. After several years of struggling with debt, Hero is back stronger than ever after its organizers made their first serious and successful campaign for corporate sponsorship.
More than 20,000 people gathered at the Sydney Opera House to open the three-week Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras Festival. Although entertainment was part of it, the speakers made powerful political statements. Mardi Gras President Julie Reagan gave particular attention to the national controversy over access to fertility treatment for women not partnered with men. In the wake of a federal court ruling that forced the state of Victoria to allow that access, Prime Minister John Howard's government moved to amend the National Sex Discrimination Act to give states the option to ban it. That bill will come before the Parliament in March. Author David Marr denounced a number of anti-gay laws and predicted that gay and lesbian voters will make their displeasure known as they go to the polls in five states this year. He vehemently criticized Catholic and Christian leaders, saying churches are the only organizations spreading homophobia in Australia.
Uganda's House of Bishops called on the government to deny official recognition to Integrity, a group of gay and lesbian Anglicans. The bishops called the group unbiblical and immoral and charged that its formation is an attempt by U.S. gays to establish an African base in Kampala. Integrity Uganda is affiliated with integrity groups in the U.S., but it was founded partly in response to a series of arrests of gay men in Uganda in 1999. Those arrests followed homophobic exhortations by President Yoweri Museveni after newspapers reported two gay weddings.
Religious leaders in the Cayman Islands are petitioning for a reinstatement of the sodomy law there. Just before the new year, Britain forced repeal of laws criminalizing homosexual acts between consenting adults in all its overseas territories to comply with international treaty obligations. Britain had first spent 2 years trying to persuade the territories to repeal their own laws, but without success. The petition to recriminalize homosexual acts is directed to Britain's governor in the Caymans and the island's own legislature. The drive is spearheaded by the Cayman Ministers Association, which calls homosexuality immoral and contrary to local culture.
Some local authorities in the Highlands of Scotland took offense at plans to promote the area as a romantic destination for gay and lesbian couples. Inspired by Madonna's recent wedding there, the Highlands of Scotland Tourist Board had received a grant for outreach to honeymooners of all kinds. But in the face of protests, the board dropped the pink part of its campaign.
Beijing gays and lesbians recently celebrated what may have been China's first TV program to give serious and sympathetic discussion to their lives and issues. But a scheduled rebroadcast of that edition of Talk It Easy was replaced by one on an entirely different topic. Hunan Star TV told callers only, "Sorry, we had no choice." One of Talk It Easy's directors was not surprised by the substitution, indicating that the original broadcast had been possible only because it was not promoted.
Anti-gay protests took a more tangible form in Taiwan in late January as someone threw a brick through the window of Taipei's gay and lesbian bookstore, Jinjin's. Since nothing was taken from the store, gays and lesbians believe it was a hate crime. The incident drew the city's gay and lesbian organizations together for a joint statement warning that if the attack with a brick is tolerated today, we might see attacks with petrol bombs in the future. We need to denounce such violence and make sure it will never happen again.
In Missouri, open gay Stanley Lingar was executed this week for the brutal 1985 murder of a 16-year-old. Some gay and lesbian groups joined death penalty opponents in seeking a life sentence for Lingar instead of death. They maintained that Lingar's sexual orientation had been intentionally used by prosecutors to inflame a rural jury against him. They also believed that Lingar's defense was incompetent, that his IQ bordered on mental retardation, and that it was more likely his partner, David Smith, who led the attack on the teen. Smith made a plea bargain agreement for a 10-year prison sentence on the condition that he testify against Lingar. Lingar had said he was too drunk to remember what happened that night. Missouri Governor Bob Holden declined requests to commute Lingar's sentence, and courts rejected appeals on his behalf.
Lingar's execution came at a time when there was evidence that gays and lesbians often do not get a fair shake in U.S. courts. Illinois' Judicial Inquiry Board this week filed an 8-count complaint with the Illinois Courts Commission against a Cook County judge, which was the board's first-ever complaint based on anti-gay bias. Judge Susan McDunn, who has already been reprimanded by the Illinois Appellate Court, allegedly acted out of personal bias to try to block second-parent adoptions by two lesbian couples.
And a week before Lingar died, the Judicial Council of California issued a report of a first-of-its-kind study that found significant anti-gay bias in the state's courts. A series of studies conducted over 6 years found that more than half of court users, such as witnesses, attorneys, and jurors, reported experiencing or observing anti-gay comment or action, most often by a lawyer or court employee. 1/5 of court employees responding to a separate survey reported hearing in open court derogatory terms, ridicule, snickering, or jokes about gays and lesbians. The Judicial Council unanimously adopted the report's recommendations and resolved to work for the appointment of more gay and lesbian judges. Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund Senior Counsel John Davidson said, "California should be proud that it is the first state to have its judiciary take up these issues," but he called the report's findings disturbing. Davidson, who worked on the report during all 6 years of its development, noted that California is one of the most progressive states when it comes to lesbian and gay equality. If the problems are this severe here, imagine what they must be like in other parts of the country.
The U.S. Bush administration made a curious U-turn on AIDS this week. First, Chief of Staff Andrew Card told USA Today that the Clinton administration's White House Office of National AIDS Policy and the Office on Race Relations would be closed down. Just hours after the newspaper hit the stands, Bush's press secretary Ari Fleischer said both would be kept open. Fleischer did not explain Card's mistake except to say he had not been aware that staffers were pursuing those initiatives. Bush himself said later, "We're concerned about AIDS inside our White House, make no mistake about it." The Gay and Lesbian Log Cabin Republicans said the new and as yet unfilled position of AIDS coordinator for the Domestic Policy Council would actually move the issue to a significantly higher position in the administration. But for some, the turnaround raised doubts about the administration's commitment to fighting the disease.
The AIDS Memorial Quilt is leaving its birthplace in San Francisco for a new home in Atlanta, Georgia. Its parent organization, the Names Project Foundation, lost its lease as San Francisco property values continue to soar. The Names Project Foundation itself is relocating to Washington, D.C. for easier access to federal lawmakers, while the quilt's new proximity to the Centers for Disease Control is also viewed as strategic. The new space in Atlanta will offer light and climate control that should help to extend the life of the quilt, which has grown to 44,000 panels and some 50 tons. Some San Francisco participants are demanding to keep their panels in that city, but a City of Atlanta spokesperson said, "For the quilt to be housed in Atlanta honors the city, and we'll do whatever we need to do to help get it here."
And finally, Britain's Advertising Standards Authority is reviewing an ad campaign mounted by Interflora before Valentine's Day. It was a little too racy for some, but a company spokesperson said, "As far as we're concerned, this is a very tasteful campaign." It included an item directed specifically towards gay men, showing a male torso with three discreetly placed but very suggestive roses. It's captioned, "Floral Sex."
And that's News Wrap for the week ending February 10th, 2001, written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Greg Gordon. Every time someone releases a list of the best gay novels or the most influential queer authors of the last century, there's invariably one name at or near the top, Edmund White. This Way Out's Steve Pride sat down with White recently to get his perspective on the struggle for equality and to chat about the literary icon's successfully queer life and work.
Edmund White is a fairly happy camper. I mean, the happiest part of my life is, I suppose, that I've been given this enormous reprieve because I was diagnosed as HIV positive in 1985. I probably was positive already by 79 or 80 because I was very active sexually. So I feel blessed in a way.
Edmund White is a novelist whose personal life reflects the course of gay history in America in the last half of the 20th century. The 22-year-old White arrived in New York City in 1962 in the formative years of gay liberation. He was a participant at the original Stonewall riots, and his early writing celebrates all the ecstasy and abandonment that soon followed. He was the co-author of The Joy of Gay Sex. He captured the excitement of Fire Island in Forgetting Elena and the gay social revolution in America in States of Desire. But Edmund White is perhaps best known for a semi-autobiographical trilogy of novels that includes A Boy's Own Story, The Beautiful Room is Empty, and The Farewell Symphony. White again draws on events in his own life in his latest book, The Married Man.
Those books probably invite the autobiographical comparison more because they're written in the first person. So there's a narrator who says I and whose life is very similar to mine. In this, I've sort of displaced things a bit and added a lot of characteristics to this guy and given him a name, Austin, and I write about him in the third person. And I think even for the writer, or even for me, once you start talking about somebody else in the third person, he begins to drift away from you. And although we share many things, we're sort of like cousins, close cousins, but not, or brothers maybe, but not identical.
You were a member of something called the Violet Quill Club. Tell me how that came about and a little bit about its members.
There were, I think, seven or eight of us, and it was 1979, 1980 that we had our meetings. They were mainly all about who could make the most luxurious desserts because we would take turns meeting in each other's houses. And it was like any writer's group. There was a feedback. There was a deadline. You had to have your chapter ready for the next meeting. And it was exciting because Andrew Holleran, who wrote Dancer from the Dance, was writing a later book. George Whitmore, who has subsequently died, was one of the writers. And Felice Picano, who's still alive, was definitely a member. And Robert Farrow and Michael Grumley. So that was pretty much the group, along with Christopher Cox. Christopher died. So, I mean, actually, it was a group of fairly young people. At that point, they were mostly in their 30s, who've all been wiped out subsequently, except for the three of us.
Although White often incorporates elements of his own life into his fiction, he is also the subject of an excellent biography by Stephen Barber called Edmund White, The Burning World.
And I should hasten to add, there's also a book by my nephew, a memoir that he's written called A Boy with a Thorn in His Side. His name is Keith Fleming, and the book is published by Morrow. And that book is about when he was a teenager in the 1970s and had a lot of problems, was put in a mental hospital, and I got him out, brought him to New York, and raised him. So that gives yet another picture of me. I'm afraid I'm getting a little overexposed.
While many writers bristle at the term gay writer, it's not a label that bothers Edmund White.
Well, I'm so happy to be known for anything. I mean, it seems to me that today literature is really beginning to languish, I think, more and more. It's harder and harder to get literary fiction recognized or sold. And so I think people should be happy to be able to occupy a little ecological niche like that. Anyway, I found it so far a very exciting thing to write about because I think, well, would it be any better to be a heterosexual writer and have to write about adultery all the time in suburban life? It seems to me that at least gay people can write about a lot of exciting things that haven't really been described to death. I have written two biographies, one of Jean Genet, who was a French playwright and novelist, and a prisoner and a pimp and a prostitute and a thief, and a very colorful and exciting figure who only died in 1986, so it was really quite recent. And in the end of his life, he defended the Palestinians and the Panthers. So he was a big political activist, always a radical, of course. And that took 7 years to write. And I saw it as kind of my AIDS work in some sort of bizarre and perverse way, in the sense that I felt like because of AIDS, everything else about gay culture was being forgotten. Nobody ever mentioned it. People only talked about this big disease. And I thought it was very important to remind everybody that there was this these literary heroes, these great artistic figures who had existed before AIDS, and Genet was one of them. And I had the luck of being able to write the first biography of him. So that was fun. And it was very successful. I mean, people, including in France, gave it nice reviews, and I got lots of awards. And so it sort of put me on the map in a way, I suppose, for my career. Then I did a very opposite kind of biography, a very short biography of Marcel Proust, because unlike Genet, I couldn't write the first one. I could write only the 2,000th one because there's a whole library full of books about Proust. So I thought all I can do is have a slightly different slant or a different analysis of his life. I can't do any original research. So my analysis was basically to write the gay Proust. I mean, I wanted to emphasize the fact that he was a gay man and that many of his characters, including female characters, were based on gay men whom he'd known.
Gay bookstores are in trouble, and while many blame chain stores and the internet, White doesn't discount what has been referred to as the dumbing down of the gay male.
Well, it used to be that when I would meet somebody who was gay, if I didn't know anything else about them, I tended to credit them with being a little bit more intelligent than the average run of humanity. Now I tend to think of them as being slightly dumber. I mean, if I don't know anything else about them, I just say, oh, a gay person, groan. And it's true that, for instance, I think when I give readings now, I notice that most of the audience will be in their 50s or older. I mean, partly that's because they're my readers who've been following me all along in my career, so naturally they're close to my age. But the owner of a bookstore in San Diego, Obelisk Books, was saying to me that that's pretty much true for any reading, no matter even if the writer is 30 years old, is that it's older people who come because they're the readers, and that it's true that Barnes & Nobles and all the big chains are offering discounted prices on gay books and do have big gay sections. So that has been very bad for independent bookstores across the board, and especially for gay bookstores. So they've gone from being 75 bookstores around America to about 50 now. And so they're shrinking rather than growing. Of course, Amazon.com hasn't helped either, you know, I mean, because and all the bookstores are threatened by that, I suppose. But yes, I think that it's true that the big gay books now will be either pornographic or they'll be photographic or they'll be humor books. I don't know whether it's the publisher's notion of what gay people are like or whether it's really what gay people are like. I suppose that there's a large group of gay people who are sort of invisible, who are either actually in the closet and married and only occasionally practice gay sex, or who have lovers, live with them quietly, are members of an academic community in a small town, say, and aren't really particularly interested in gay culture. I think there are an awful lot of people like that who would rather read books in their own field or would rather read books that everyone reads that don't feel any particular link to gay culture, which does seem more and more idiotic, more body-related, more glitzy, more commercialized, more packaged, more stupid than ever before. So I think that's a problem. I mean, mind you, we still have great gay writers like Alan Hollinghurst, who I personally feel is one of the handful of the great American or English writers, English language writers in the world today. So that's pretty good for a tiny minority. I mean, I honestly believe that gays only represent about 3% of the population. So we're really a tiny minority. And the idea that we have so many great writers is actually fairly astonishing.
But gay culture is about more than literature and the arts. It's also about sex. According to Edmund White,
I'm not at all opposed to the group Sex Panic, who I think are actually fighting what they and I would call gay Puritans or gay neoconservatives, people who really feel that all gays should be monogamous and married. And as you and I both know, and most people who are sensible know, monogamy is not going to preserve people from AIDS. Promiscuity is not the cause of AIDS. What's the cause of AIDS is unsafe sex, and that more often happens with one single partner than it does with a host of partners. So anyway, Sex Panic is a group that's been opposed to the Larry Kramers of this world or the Bruce Bowers, all these gay pundits who've written books with titles like A Place at the Table or Notes from the Holocaust, and who are the right wing of the gay movement. So I'm all for Sex Panic. But on the other hand, I get apoplectic when I hear about bareback sex, because I think that's just crazy. And it's a shame if young people think that because the protease inhibitors that they're now safe and they can do whatever they want.
There's a nostalgia for the pre-AIDS days, an envy for the people that were actually able to get through it and have that wild party, as Brad Gooch called it in his last readable book, the golden age of promiscuity. Why was it so golden, and how do we make up for that loss?
It was golden, I think, for a number of reasons. One was that, after all, gay liberation had only begun in 1969, so suddenly there was an enormous proliferation of gay visibility, of gay bars, backroom bars, all this kind of stuff. And there's this brief window between the beginning of gay liberation and the beginning of AIDS, so really 10 or 12 years. And I think that defines the golden age. It was also a period of gay confidence, of flourishing of gay arts, beginning of dozens of gay organizations, whether they were local student organizations or the Gay Academic Union or hundreds of different things, and lots of gay publications. So it was a period when people felt triumphant, really. And all of that was dashed with the onslaught of the disease in the beginning of the 80s. How can that be recuperated? I don't know. I suppose it will be the day that somebody invents a cure for AIDS or a vaccine. I think I sat down to calculate that I lived in New York between the ages of 22 and 42, which was all pre-AIDS. And if I had sex three times a week, it came out to 3,000 or something. I'm not too good at math. But anyway, it was a very high number. But actually, most men my age who lived in a big city and who weren't involved with a monogamous relationship, they all say, well, that was normal. In fact, why didn't you have more sex?
But don't misunderstand. Edmund White has nothing against gay monogamous couples with children, minivans, and the inevitable white picket fence.
My sister, for instance, is a lesbian, and she runs an adoption agency mainly for biracial kids. And I think she's placed quite a few with lesbian or gay couples. So I'm all for that, and I think it's actually quite radical. I mean, the truth is that since marriage is one of the most sacred institutions in our society, if gays can really finally break that code and get married officially, it will really legitimize gay life in a way that almost nothing else ever has. So I'm all for that. Personally, I wouldn't want it. I mean, I always felt that the strongest suit for gays was to be bohemian and to live outside the ordinary rules of traditional society. And I feel like our real contribution lay in that area. But I'm not about to deny somebody else their rights. I mean, I'd fight for their rights. I'm all for gay adoption, gay marriage, gay inheritance, gay whatever. But I just personally wouldn't want to do that. What's interesting is that all this has been kind of de-dramatized and de-symbolized in France, my spiritual homeland, in the sense that they've passed this law, Pax, which is a very successful thing. It was passed 2 years ago, and it means that any two people who've lived together for 3 years or more in the same household can get married. That is, they can form a civil union, and it can be mother and daughter, two sisters, a brother and a sister, a husband and his ex-wife, or anybody else, or two gay men or two lesbians. And all that's important is that they can prove that they are living under the same roof and intend to continue doing so and have done so at least for 3 years. Well, what's good about that is that they actually enjoy all rights that a married couple enjoys except the right to adopt. That's the one thing that has yet to come in France. But it was interesting because when it was originally proposed as gay marriage, every legislator started howling in France and they rejected it. But when they reframed it in this light of being a civil union between two people who happen to live together and can be any possible combination of age, relationship, sex, or whatever, then it passed. And so I think that was a very good way to de-dramatize the whole thing. Because marriage sounds like a holy union and therefore invokes the church, and most Christian sects still are very opposed to homosexual unions. Whereas civil union sounds like it's the other side. It's like a legal institution.
This has been a conversation with author Edmund White. I'm Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
It's a nice day for a white wedding. It's a nice day to start again. Wow! There's nothing fair in this world. There is nothing safe in this world, and there's nothing sure in this world, and there's nothing pure in this world. Look for something left in this world. Start again. I'm always a nice day for a white wedding. Day to start again. It's a nice day to start again.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Chris Ambidge, Graham Underhill, Jason Lynn, Brian Nunes, Rex Walkner, Matt Alsdorf, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Billy Idol performed White Wedding, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by grants from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and the CP Estes Guadalupe Fund by PlanetOut.com, from designated contributions by Uncommon Cloud Visa cardholders who've chosen This Way Out, and through direct charitable donations from our listeners around the world. For audio cassette information or with any questions or comments about This Way Out, please email us at tworadio@aol.com, visit our webpage at thiswayout.org, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. And please be sure to include the call letters of this station. Remember, you can also hear This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. Just point your browser to www.planetout.com and click first on Multimedia, then on Radio. For Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KUOI Moscow, Idaho, Fresh Radio, Nelson Marlborough, New Zealand, WEFT Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, and more than 125 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Do stay tuned.